You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, here on Radio Albion, and this is being recorded on the last day of June, 2024. Before I get started, continuing what we did last week, I don't want you guys to forget about Sven Longshanks. Things are definitely looking up for him. And just don't forget about it. It's sometimes it's too difficult to contemplate for long, but keep him in mind, please. Last week, I mentioned that a group in Greece sent me a series of questions to answer in writing. It wasn't an interview. A verbal interview, which, as I also said last week, I prefer. And to my surprise, I only got about halfway through. And the reason I'm using those questions for this show is that I occasionally get a request to go back to basics, the basic fundamental ideas that a nationalist has to have. You know, paleo-conservative nationalists, agrarian monarchists, all related but not identical ideas. Not so much a primer, but going over the fundamentals. For the most part, I don't do issue by issue like the your typical postmodern will do. When I say fundamentals, I'm talking about that which underlies all of these issues. What is the consistent fundamental object? Essentially, you know, the Platonic form or natural law, the nature of justice, the nature of right. And we ended last week on the question concerning the struggle between liberalism and nationalism playing out in the future. And it's very difficult in this climate to even talk about public activity, since the regime has that completely sewn up. That goes for elections or anything else. I don't vote. I've never voted a day in my life, and I spent some time explaining that. So in terms of actual strategy, I don't have much to say. But one of my consistent positions is that because this is an unsustainable economic system, Europe and America, it's eventually going to implode. It's going to collapse in on itself, especially, you know, given the nature of offshoring. At the end of last week, the talk last week, I made the point that liberalism and nationalism are opposites. They don't have anything in common. Even, you know, if you could even have a national Bolshevism as a political ideology floating around out there. There is no such thing as a national liberalism. That's like a Roman Catholic orangeman. It doesn't make sense. Liberalism begins from the point of view of the isolated Cartesian ego. Now, I've also criticized that point of view in general, and the whole the discovery of the ego in René Descartes' meditations. Countries like Ukraine that have come through the worst human tyranny, invasion, warfare for centuries, and yet survives and even thrives years ago, is on the verge of dissolution due to liberalism. It's a corrosive ideology that starts from the point of view of the isolated individual. I also said that there's no useful concept of right, duty, justice, unless it's based on a living cultural unity. Rights are specific to a nation because despite there being universal problems and universal issues, how they get resolved is something very specific to different groups of people. And the universal issues are the content of natural law, which I'll mention here more in a minute. Human nature being what it is, clearly there are commonalities, society to society to society. How that's dealt with in a civic way, that's a linguistic, national conception. So you have universal issues and how they're manifest in a society, especially its scale of priorities, is going to differ. Even the use of the term public, it's you can't be talking about a random gaggle of people. To be a people, to be a nation, they have to be constituted by broad and complex ideas of language and history, basic agreement on moral concepts. The truth is that debate, discussion, civic life implies basic agreement on fundamentals. Of course, that ship has sailed in the Western world, since the very nature of the Western world and the ethnicities that make it up is under attack. So individualism and hence liberalism, the ego disconnected from all the institutions around it, these are mental orientations. And they came into existence the way we know them, in the Italian city-states, usury, and then later industrialization. It's where you begin. You can start with the isolated ego and take that as paramount, but that doesn't make a lot of sense because the isolated ego can't exist. It needs an entire society to sustain it. A national society can exist without a contradiction. It's the very nature of globalization to destroy any significant forms of identity outside its own consumer and media nexus. The fanatical nature of the anti-nationalist idea coming out of Washington or London is extraordinary. And every once in a while, the regime will pick a favorite national group, like Ukraine, for example, or Albania, not that long ago, and very hypocritically support that sort of nationalism. If they temporarily serve the Washington consensus, that kind of national unity becomes important. But in general, it's something that the liberal West rejects, and that is, liberalism is the official ideology of Western society. So to create centers of identity, forms of belonging, that disempowers capital, and it keeps it from taking over the psyche and reducing the nation to simply random individuals. So if you claim that the nation is this imagined entity, this mythical state of affairs, then, as I also said last week, there's no place to stand to condemn imperialism. Imperialism can't exist without nations, since the very nature of imperialism is that nations are enslaved and exploited by a colonizing power. You can't be under foreign occupation if there's no entity that's being occupied. The word communitarianism has been around for a while. In academia, it was the way that the left was able to moderate its concern with the individual rights. And it's a community really without definition. If the community is taken as paramount, the whole comes before the parts, then the ego is circumscribed. My book on Alistair MacIntyre gets into this abstract communitarianism and how it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But I use the term simply to refer to a cultural community. These are romantic concepts. There's no nation. There's no body of a people without an articulated culture. The nation, the ethnic group, is the foundation for anything else that gets erected on top of it. The state, the crown, the church, whatever. Even the concept of an empire implies that you have more or less independent nations operating under its protection. And for various reasons, it's in their interest to come under an emperor. But of course, the traditional ideology of Byzantium, Russia, is to allow the ethnic groups under it to be more or less autonomous. I've always found that the arguments against nationalism, remember, we're not really necessarily talking about the state right away here. I always thought that these arguments against nationalism were special pleading, that they're anemic, that they're unoriginal. Because if you reject the notion of the nation, the ethnic group, that comes to define your place in the whole, your selfhood is going to be created by something else. You don't create yourself. That's simply not possible. You could always ask the question, based on what? So either the ethnicity, the nation, helps define the self, or economic elites, especially foreign ones, will do it. It's one or the other. For many, many years, I've made the claim that societies, ethnic groups, nations, could only choose between royalism, the common good, and oligarchy, or the private good, the good of those with money or pursuing money. And there's not a whole lot of leeway in between. Now, when I say monarchy, I'm not talking about necessarily a crown, but it could be a military government. It could be a party system completely dedicated to the common good and unity above all things. Capital, since its very conception, has been planetary in scope. Industrialization was preceded by colonialism. And there's the argument that colonial possessions is what created the surplus to build industry. Capital was never a national entity, especially when you consider, you know, Portugal, Japan, the Netherlands. They're too small to have their own economy. It is planetary. It is global from the very beginning. Money is money. But why stop there? Human rationality itself can never be separated from the community. This is one of the things that made Hegel so interesting to me, because that's the core of his belief system. Man is not born free. He is not born rational, although the faculty certainly exists. But those faculties develop as a young man is exposed to the stock of intellectual culture found in any normal national community. Early on, of course, that's the job of the family and the educational system, which can be from the state, although it doesn't have to be. But to be able to use your rational potential assumes that there's a functioning civic culture and that basic needs are being met through the division of labor. So a strong public ethos, public virtue, social stability, those are absolutely necessary ingredients to exemplifying man's nature as a rational being. Rationality is contingent on being part of a healthy cultural community. The nation, in other words, treated as an extended family. Over time, the division of labor develops its own tradition and customs. The interaction within one language, culture. It's those traditions that form the rational faculty itself. And from that, you derive the various trains of thought that mark what you might call European civilization. Abstraction is artificial. The culture is not. from liberalism to Marxism to postmodernism is this descent. The traditions of civilization have been rejected in favor of the abstract and alienated ego, which serves the interests of capital. It doesn't matter who owns it. Whether you have the moral agent of liberalism, the material creator of wealth for the Marxists, or the consumer for the capitalists, all three, in a very similar way, are errors. Membership has been reduced to citizenship. There is no such thing as abstract rationality. It has to derive from something. Tyranny, alienation, materialism, these are the direct result of the rejection of man as both a tradition-bearing and a cultural-bearing entity. They are absolutely, man as a tradition-bearer is central to his freedom, as Hegel would say. And to reject that is a perversion. The ultimate goal, to remake the person into an abstract cog in the status machine. Now, the question that this was in response to is seeing the struggle between liberalism and nationalism playing out, as I've already mentioned. And every once in a while, I use the phrase natural law. Another term for that might be human nature. Put differently, what do all societies have in common? Many years ago, I read an article in the Thomist. I was still in grad school. Then it tried to lay out this question, and hence these things are natural to man. They're not socially constructed. Or they may be in their detail, but certainly not in their essence. So examples would be an economic system that serves everyone, especially the creators of wealth. And there has to be a division of labor, however primitive. The sacrosanct nature of marriage and family. There is no society that doesn't have this. Of course, you need a currency. You need a way to establish a stable form of interaction, economically speaking. But I also think things like hierarchy and nobility is to be found in every non-postmodern society. And the virtues. No society has ever existed that praises cowardice or faithlessness. All societies have rejected that because it goes right to the heart of self-defense. There has to be an educational system, the transmission belt of the tradition from one generation to another. There has to be some kind of constitution, law, and what amounts to a social control system, a way that could be enforced in a way that's equitable. Religion, the existence of God, however it might be understood, is, or even the supernatural in general, is found in every culture that's ever existed. And of course, all of this is tied down to the systems of communication, that is language. All societies have strongly limited sexuality, being well aware of its power and how it can be used to manipulate people. Even things like the arts of all kinds. There's no society that doesn't have that. But the extended family is a very big deal. And the only society that seems to reject these things is the postmodern one. Prior to modernity, adultery was treated and punished very harshly. Even a certain level of technology embedded within a division of labor. All of these things are natural to man. Hence, they make up human nature, human nature relative to social life. Those things, and those are just, I'm sure there's others, these are inherent to human functioning. And this is what it permits human nature to work itself out. You have to have, for everything I mentioned, there has to be a basic civic sameness. Language, custom, basic moral ideas has to be there before anything else can be done. This culture is another term for the ethnos. Let me quote someone I've quoted several times in the past, Metropolitan St. Philaret of Moscow, and his political views. In fact, this is directly from his sermon on the day of his most pious majesty, the Emperor Nicholas Pavlovich. And here's how he defines the state, not necessarily just as a bureaucracy, but society as a whole. The state is a union of free moral beings, united among themselves with the sacrifice of part of their freedom for the preservation and confirmation by the common forces of law and morality, which constitutes the necessity of their existence. Civil laws are nothing other than interpretations of this law in application to particular cases and guards placed against its violation. But of course, at the time, it was taken for granted the nature of this unity was something more than sheer will. It has to be a basic common language and faith in the broad sense. What he refers to as the common forces of law and morality, at its fundamentals, it has to be accepted by everyone. Because communication breaks down. As I've said many times, the monarch rules the ethno-nation in the same sense, at least analogously, as the father ruling over the family. Why would anyone part with any of their freedom, using St. Philaret's definition, unless it was for something that you recognize, something that constitutes who you are, the faith, the tradition, the culture, the people? The nation, then, not the state, is faith, is common culture, and it's simply assumed to exist because you can't even talk about a people, a society, or a unity without it. This is at the core of human nature. This is how human nature works itself out. And when you reject it, well, you have postmodern America that rejects all forms of identity and hence pours in alien, often criminal elements and people seeking handouts, contrary to the mythology on the topic. Because there is no nation, there is no community. Only when those institutions are destroyed can you have what we call the Great Replacement. Because these things are, as I've called them, the strictures of survival. This is what a people has had to go through to establish themselves. And that becomes the core of the culture itself. But when you reject that very idea, then anything goes. And I covered a lot of this last week. Next question he asked, now we're getting more specific, and that's the nature of the Ukrainian conflict and its global implications. And I think most of you know my answer to that. And I'm saying that the slaughter of good Ukrainian men in this war is the greatest tragedy of the 21st century so far. And it shows the level of media control, the importance of Johnson's Law, that the more obscure a nation, the more the press can lie about it, since there's so few to say, to reject, you know, to challenge it. I also said that you can't approach the events in Eastern Europe and Ukraine specifically without understanding that Ukraine is not an independent country. It is a colonial possession entirely dependent on Western handouts to function. But the myths that the regime has created is what helps justify the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian boys. Boys and men. And I mean that in a gendered way. I have a book out on Ukrainian nationalism, and it has nothing to do with the government in Kiev, which has no connection to Ukrainian tradition, which was the point of that book. In the first place, not so much to reject, it was to reject the Orange Revolution and everything that it's based on. But the Kiev state that these boys are dying for has zero legitimacy. The regime relies on the ignorance of its academics, journalists, and especially these recycled experts, not to mention mass censorship. And it's a very tight control over public perception. A strict filtering of the flow of information. To the point where, as many of you know, in Europe, pro-Russian outlets like RT or whatever are blocked. But the tragedy is that Ukraine is presently being depopulated. And I say that's the only thing that it could offer the Western oligarchy, the regime, is to act as cannon fodder. Liberalism has one dominant enemy right now, and that is Russia. The Great Reset. Russia is the enemy. Using Ukrainian boys for this purpose, almost a way to repay debt, that certainly is genocidal. February of 2022, the war began, coming on the heels of many attacks against Novorossiya and Crimea by the Kievan government. Constant artillery and drone attacks against the eastern part of the country from Kiev. They're constant. It's irrational. Regular shelling of civilian centers by the so-called Ukrainian military and private paramilitaries trained by NATO, which today is largely a memory. Putin's invasion of Ukraine was long in coming and was meant to be preemptive. You had a massive military buildup in the eastern part of Ukraine orchestrated by the U.S., and it was nearing completion. They were going to invade and destroy New Russia. And had Russia not intervened, the Donetsk and Luhansk would have been completely destroyed. Ethnically speaking, of course, Novorossiya is Russian-speaking and Orthodox, and they've always rejected the disaster of the successive Kievan states. Russians in Ukraine are by far the most productive segment of the population. Many of you have heard of what happened in Crimea. This is just one event out of many. If this is what they're going to do to the population without controlling it, can you imagine what they'll do when they do take control over, which Russia, of course, has made impossible? Eastern regions of Ukraine voted many times to leave the sinking ship of Ukraine and even fought to become part of Russia in the battlefield starting in 2014. And the 2022 war is a direct continuation of this. What some people overlook is that Novorossiya's battle-hardened militia has performed very well. But this is why Russia demands Ukraine be demilitarized. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian men have been drafted into the army, while an equally huge number was fled across the border to dodge conscription. Women, too, in huge numbers have left the country, bringing many professions to a standstill, especially, you know, critical utilities. Ukraine has been third world for a long time. And it's collapsed both financially and now demographically. Even giving away the land as repayment for debt, even that's now insufficient. The debt is being repaid in blood. There's really nothing left except the promise to fight Russia as an American proxy, which is a strategy taken from the 1990s in Kosovo, Albania. And this is why money continues to pour into a country that has no real functioning government and an economy so irrational that unless it was propped up by Western aid, would not exist at all. Even profits are second in the regime's mind to defeat Russia. It is a pathological construction of their mind. Russia isn't Russia in the regime. It's something that they have constructed to a great extent from projection. But the only reason you have this scandal of this forced conscription, not to mention high levels of desertion, that can only exist because of huge combat losses, let alone the total lack of trust in the government in Kiev. Ukrainians, Ukraine, do not benefit from American policy. This is a meat grinder. Young Ukrainian boys being sent against an enemy that has not done them harm. In fact, to the contrary. Ukraine's economy has to be based on Russia in the East. Now, I know the legislative head of Zelensky's party at a commune. First name is David. He said in early 2023 that combat losses were about 1,000 killed or wounded daily. The Daily Mail said in July of 2022 that the running death toll was about 20,000 per month. But given Russian firepower, that does make a lot of sense. Official statistics are secret, so the American press can invent whatever numbers they want. But the Deputy Defense Minister, Anna Malyar, who frankly I don't think has any idea what a battlefield looks like, stated that the numbers of dead are a state secret during martial law due to military expediency, and that the enemy can't know the true numbers, which means it's bad, and it's worse than even I think. That kind of talk means that the numbers are higher and more horrid than anyone recognizes. And if it became public knowledge, the government in Kiev at, 0% approval would somehow, mathematically impossible, go to negative numbers. I want to repeat something I've said at least once a month, that none of this happened against the USSR. The level of fanaticism, doing everything in the West's power to destroy Russia, that was not the case. In fact, the opposite was the case in the USSR. The US right now is trying to force NATO members to strengthen their military capacity. They don't have the money. They don't have the experience for this. And Washington, of course, wants to increase its contingent in Europe. 60,000 men as of a year ago, probably higher now. 2024, the goal is to get it to 100,000, although no one explains where these men and supplies will come from, because the U.S. at the best of times is greatly overstretched. And on the battlefield in Ukraine and in Afghanistan, American equipment is proving itself unreliable. Not to mention that supply stocks are at critical levels. It's going to take a lot of work to convince me that the U.S. will directly intervene in either Israel or Ukraine. But connecting this to everything that we've said already, the U.S. has no internal unity. It's bankrupt not just morally, but financially too. Military record has been terrible since 1945. And since the Cold War ended, very little public support for these wars. There was a little blip after 9/11. I can't imagine the Americans facing off against a youthful and motivated, for example, Chinese military with the forces that it has. Because in any hotspot, the U.S. can only dedicate a fairly small percentage of their capacity, since they have to, they have bases all over the planet. The other reason I don't think the U.S. will intervene directly is that their weakness will be exposed. Maybe it's going too far to say that the Ukrainian conflict will be the grave of American empire, but I do think it'll be the birthplace of the Sino-Russian economic order. So that's the basic summary point of view I have on the Ukrainian conflict. Most of you know about this. It's a big area of specialization, and that's actually an important point, that because these nations and cultures have developed over time very distinctive and his myriad of variables going into building it, being an area specialist is absolutely essential. You have to pick something. Russo-Ukraine, China, Korea, Philippines, whatever it is, to see how different nations have come into existence. And these are very complex discussions. It doesn't eliminate universal concerns, but you can only get the good out of how a culture comes into existence by specializing in it. Because there's so much material on it right now. Next question is essentially my perspective on Israel. Israel, of course, the present Jews, the so-called Israelis, have no connection with the Old Testament, either racially or religiously. But what's very impressive about this conflict is that, and I have mentioned this before, what would motivate the initial Hamas attack? A lot of young men risking death, life-altering injuries, or Israeli prisons. And what motivates them is that Gaza was already on the verge of total dissolution. And not just physically, either. The Palestinians and the Gaza Strip have nothing. No one else in the world is forced to live this way. The border has been sealed. Gazans live under severe deprivation. Deprivation that only Israel can get away with. They were caged in Gaza. They had zero hope for the future. Prior to last October, Gazans were already under siege for 20 years. Perfectly consistent, of course, with liberal democracy. Imports of food barely above starvation levels. Sanctions are never supposed to include things like medical supplies, but that's included here. Gaza land was declared by the UN to be too contaminated to sustain life, and that was before the war started. Even fishing. The Israeli Navy and Coast Guard fire on fishing boats all the time. Israel, a few years ago, declared a buffer zone, taking a third of Gaza's agricultural land, you know, such as it is. And it's not just stealing resources on land, but also natural gas off the coast of Gaza. And there was a time where the Israeli Supreme Court said that belongs to Palestine, not Israel. Palestinians have voted for Hamas in 2006 and beyond because it had a reputation for honesty and very strict morality. They're a social service organization primarily, like Hezbollah is. Of course, Israel immediately claimed that they were a terrorist entity. But I think Hamas follows international law more closely than Israel ever did. There were weekly protests prior to the war on the Gaza Strip, the Great March of Return. Shooting civilians from the IDF is normal. It's just a matter of daily life. Crimes that the Western media refuse to deal with in any systematic way. And of course, the Israeli occupation policy in the West Bank, since everything is focused on Gaza, settlers, and there's many people in Netanyahu's government that are from the settlements, that they're killing many Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, since the eye is not on them. One of the most obnoxious parts of all this is now that criticism of Israel has gone mainstream, which is a very dangerous policy, for the world Jews, they can isolate Netanyahu, because his coalition, at least in their public pronouncements, were, Jews only, anti-homo, that kind of thing. So they feel like if you can isolate Netanyahu and say, it's like the Soviet Union, that the Gulag solely existed under Stalin, which of course is ridiculous, that this kind of policy exists only under Netanyahu. They're equally false claims. Hamas had no choice but to bring their situation to world attention this way. And they knew what the result was going to be. Some of you, I don't know if you've all heard this or not, but I rejected the idea that Israel somehow was behind the invasion. I don't think that's true. But as it stands now, the Israeli state is seeking a second mass expulsion, the Nakba, of most, if not all, Gazans. The massive flood of refugees are going to damage whatever country they settle in. A million Palestinians from Gaza, for example, in Sinai or even Jordan, could crash the economy. Egypt, the same thing. The U.S.-financed Arab Spring has not seen really financial rewards at all. Jordan is in no position to deal with this. And the domestic fallout from this, from both of those countries, is monstrous. Many of you also know that I've spent a lot of time on the South African case against Israel in the International Criminal Court. And some of the evidence for Israeli genocide is quoting people like Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, who called Arabs human animals, That's a true blood libel against Tel Aviv's enemies. Initially, when Israeli reporters were brought into the invasion staging area, no mass murder claims were made at the time. But it seems that the regime is trying to isolate this to Netanyahu, but it's still a very dangerous game. Giora Eliand, who was a former general in the IDF, came right out and said, we have to create an unprecedented humanitarian disaster. A fact that today is well known. The IDF ordered the general evacuation in northern Gaza, but they have nothing to, if they leave, they have nothing to return to. The Israelis say only Israel can decide when you guys can come back. War crimes are taking place according to deliberate design. The point is to murder civilians and terrorize the population into submission. But contrary to the regime's propaganda, there's nothing special about Netanyahu except having so many settlers in his cabinet. But it's very interesting that when it comes to Hezbollah or Hamas, Israel has failed to conquer them. The raid back in October shattered Israel's myth of invincibility that Israel enjoyed since 1967, since the war. This certainly has destroyed Netanyahu's career. The settler movement is represented, as I've already mentioned, by the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, both born in settlements on the West Bank. So many in at least the older cabinet of Netanyahu is openly talking about depopulation. But it's becoming more and more difficult since Israel's been fought to a standstill. Israel's already fought Hezbollah and lost. Hezbollah, at least locally, is the best equipped and trained group Israel has to deal with. It used to be Syria, and the civil war put an end to that, at least temporarily. The Israelis certainly realize that Hezbollah would mobilize after any kind of activity like Hamas. Again, it's another reason why I reject the Israel is in on it thesis. I've talked about that before. I'm not sure what the IDF is going to do since they're overstretched. And the complete severance of relationships with wealthy Arab states has now, of course, permanently been destroyed. I also made the point of saying that moderate Arab states, or at least Islamic states, will fall for not taking sufficient action in defense of the Palestinians. Iran and Turkey, who have good relations, can challenge Israel successfully. But Syria, Iraq, Sudan, Libya have been reduced to fourth world status, which was the entire goal of these operations. Israel uses the U.S. to keep her rivals poor and ignorant. Turkey is a wild card, and it's really the first time we could say that. In this particular war, Turkey has by far the largest military in the Middle East, completely first world. NATO can fall to pieces if Turkey takes action. But Turkey's policy is kind of all over the place, as many of you have noticed. But for the first time in a very long time, Israel's in serious trouble. Ammunition and supply stocks were drawn to nothing in favor of Kiev, let alone what the U.S. has to offer the Israelis. The U.S. is totally unprepared and really incapable of managing any conflict, let's say in Taiwan or even Central Asia. The U.S. is incapable of dealing with Russia, Iran, or China. But the Gaza conflict is pressing the American empire even further beyond its capabilities. And none of this serves Israeli interests. To believe that the U.S. could be manipulated into attacking Iran in terms of a major invasion, let's say from Azerbaijan, that's anything but obvious. The U.S. could not defeat the Taliban. there's no reason that they would defeat the First World Army of the Iranians. The former Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, now that he's out of that, I think I've mentioned this before, he's talking about the doubling of the American defense budget, another $1 trillion per year, which is barely the interest payments on the debt. The regime demands the U.S. as a global military, and where any kind of increase in the defense budget, where that money will come from, let alone its manpower problems, its morale problems, these aren't easily solved. Same thing goes for the supply problems. The U.S. won't give up its ambition to control the world militarily. Overstretch is an understatement. And in terms of supply, you have decades of deindustrialization for short-term profit, investing abroad. So there's no domestic capacity for increased production, even if the money was there. The U.S. couldn't defeat the Taliban, any war with Hamas or Hezbollah will end the exact same way. Hezbollah is impressively stocked, contrary to the U.S. Hezbollah and Israel have faced off before. The last time Israel invaded Lebanon, Hezbollah stopped Israeli tanks and destroyed the South Lebanon army. Which, you know, I mentioned that the invasion shattered the myth of Israeli invincibility. But it's very easy to forget about this. Hezbollah has already taken on the Israelis and won. I don't care how many aircraft carriers the U.S. sends to the coast. I strongly doubt a lot on these carriers are battle ready. But Netanyahu is seeing his career and his reputation sent to nothing. He wasn't in on it. Next question is about Greece. The current state of Greece, its struggles with national sovereignty, etc. The nature of Greek identity. Now, many of you know my concern with the Greeks goes from Plato to the Middle Ages, the Byzantine Empire. The modern Greek world is not something I deal with all the time. But there's no denying that Greeks are one of the world's elite peoples. But like every nation on the globe, it's being rotted from within. Free trade, individualism, oligarchy, this crude cosmopolitanism, which, by the way, is one of the reasons that God destroyed Israel. The prophets in the Old Testament spoke of loyalty to race, nation, and faith, essentially three of the same thing, to make that the focus of loyalty. The economic system, whether imposed on Greece or elsewhere, is non-sustainable because usury eliminates any rewards for labor. Nationalism, whether Greek or otherwise, is a part of natural law, no different than the family is. Ethnicity is the creation of God, and therefore the canons accept ethnic churches. You know what? 10 years ago, Greece went into its massive downward spiral, and that has not stopped. There's been almost no recovery. The debt to GDP, both public and private, is ridiculous. 200% at least debt compared to GDP. The Greeks should have left the Eurozone, but they did not. They almost did. What's funny is that now, however they're defining economic growth these days, the claim now is that Greece is one of the fastest growing economies in Europe. Well, their credit rating is still BBB negative, but they are planning on improving it, hence bringing in investors who, or so it's said, will be driving the economy. Allegedly growing twice the rate of the Eurozone average. Well, since the Eurozone growth rate is zero, or even negative, growing faster than that isn't saying anything. And we know about the nature of statistics, especially in the U.S., but certainly abroad as well. To enter the Eurozone, Greeks past governments falsified data. The claim is that the unemployment rate's 11% in Greece, 8% in the rest of the EU. I think those numbers are a fraction of the truth. Poverty from the austerity programs is what you have when liberalism takes over and goes to war against national solidarity. Liberalism is the enemy. And it's successful because it doesn't operate in a frontal way. Greece has some of the most expensive, out of control fuel costs, food costs, power of all kinds, not to mention high taxes. It's not uncommon that you would have Greeks not being able to deal with basic necessities. Prime Minister Mitsotakis, who is a neoliberal of a sort, believes that, you know, cheap labor and inflation are the ways to create a strong economy. But however they're defining economic growth, you have a situation where you have no new production orders and inventories are way up, meaning that the economy is a negative number. Inventories pile up as a matter of overproduction. The Greeks under Mitsotakis sent a huge amount of weapon to Ukraine and apparently is at war with Russia, sort of. Kyriakos Mitsotakis said in Bloomberg, I can't remember, at least a couple of years ago, that they are at war with Russia, according to the prime minister. Now, the dominant industry, where the oligarchy comes from, the ship owners, that you have recently, say over the last year and a half, increased oil shipments from Russia, which has put Greece in NATO's crosshairs. The present Greek prime minister defended sanctions and yet turns a blind eye to this. In other words, he's playing both sides of the war. The ship owners are able to, or the shipping magnates are able to sway governments one way or the other. And in fact, the CIA via Kiev, a few people, Antonopoulos and a few others have noted this. They compiled a blacklist of the big shipping magnates in Greece tied to the ruling party, the New Democracy Party. And of course, the U.S. via Kiev has condemned this overwhelmingly, hoping that there would be individual sanctions on these companies. Military relations with the U.S. since at least 2021 have been the norm, growing closer to the West at the expense of its relationship with Moscow. The Greeks have strong military ties with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and even India, refusing to join the anti-Chinese campaign. Alexander Dugin talks about Greece as part of Rimland, the Mackinder, the Inner Crescent. Greece is interesting because it can be either Athenian or Spartan. It's an open identity. It could go between Eurasia, the land power, or the sea power, USA, UK, etc. Athens was your classic sea power. Sparta, of course, and other groups, classic land powers. All Greek, though. Mitsotakis posits this two geographical regions, the horizontal one from Portugal to the Persian Gulf, and the vertical one from the Balkans into North Africa. The present foreign minister, Nikos Dendias, said that Greece's ambition is to act as a bridge between the Eastern Mediterranean and the Gulf. Now, concepts of the bridge, they're it's so overused as to really be meaningless, but playing both sides off against each other isn't exactly the acts of a major power. But the pivot towards the West is being challenged. There was a sense of inferiority to Turkey, that Greece couldn't compete with the Turks because of what the Turks actually possess, the Bosporus Straits, for example, that they have quite a bit of leverage, especially being a NATO power, much larger than Greece, to fight Greek interests. And yet, if you remember my talk on Cyprus, and that was a Greek success story, largely because it was homogenous. It was Greek, Greek-speaking. The strongest nationalists are from Cyprus. And the fact I've mentioned, it was a long time ago, that it's not an accident that the Greek military coup of 1967, they're mostly from Cyprus. Another question he asked of me, the ancient Greek religious heritage, or the cultural heritage, and its creation of modern national identity. And the minute you start talking like that, I go back to Byzantium. Byzantium was, to a great extent, a Greek entity in a very broad sense, although in the beginning it was Latin. It was universalist, but not cosmopolitan, and it was based on the Greek language after a short time. Given what we've said about human nature and natural law, that's the extent of the universalism. And the emperor has been seen, from almost the very founding of Christian Byzantium. The emperor was the incarnation of law, so to speak, a secondary incarnation. And the laws ultimately are of divine origin. The church is directly established by God, but the state is required for the basic discipline and regularity protection of the church who had sewn up domestic policy. The emperor, the church, it exists for the common good. The two powers come from the same source and have a similar end. The emperor was not a secular power whatsoever. He was a religious institution. The emperor was not really a directly political figure. The source of law is God. This is one of the great Greek metaphysical realities that completely undergirds Western civilization, both Eastern and Western. God created nature and hence the laws by which it functions. Laws have to have an author, and the author has to be above those very same laws, his own creation. The law has a single source, but is manifest in three different ways. At least three different ways. The church canon, laws and constitution of the empire, the nation, and then the laws of the natural order. They appear differently given our lack of knowledge. But this is the source for Greek identity, not the Enlightenment revolutionaries who took over from the Ottomans. It's been a long time since I've dealt with those issues. But the Greek revolutionaries, the 19th century, were opposed to the Ottoman state, not on any imperial grounds, but because it was a backward and medieval empire. I did a whole show a few years ago on the church's relation to this very question. So the concept of Byzantium was completely turned on its head in the 19th century, in the War of Independence. Prior to that, though, the emperor was an element of God's law on earth, except with a specific and limited set of powers. Human beings without law is kind of like a body without a brain. But these are eternal truths that even predate orthodoxy. Orthodoxy placed limits on the emperor's power that may not have existed previously. The very nature of canon law in the church places limits on royal authority, or any political authority for that matter. Anything not sanctioned in that way has no force of law. And that doesn't change just because we live in a revolutionary time, or a post-revolutionary time. As far as Greece is concerned, the calendar question has to be solved. But in the ancient world, the form of law was to be found in the emperor, but its moral and spiritual content were the domain of the church. What it means that the emperor would receive his power from God means that he brought order from the chaos of tribalism, building civilization, not, of course, cosmopolitanism. And these are truths that Greece has ignored since its independence. The Greek independence fighters tended to look towards France. The nature of the revolutionary order, which they used against the Ottoman state. But bringing this into more contemporary terms, some of you may remember my paper on the Greek coup of 1967. I'm going to quote myself here. Democracy had failed again. A split population, an obvious decline in public morals, a failing economy, strikes and street protests, squabbling politicians, pompous speechmaking, institutionalized lying, threats, and endless other problems created by the democratic system had the Greek people outraged. And the coup was received with cheers from the population. The coup took place on April 21st, 1967, just short of the elections that everyone knew would be totally irrelevant and would simply prolong the agony that Greece had become. The approval was almost ecstatic. Arrogant politicians and the generals were arrested en masse as the beneficiaries of Greek poverty and misery. These were fairly low-level officers. Generals were seen as oligarchs, but these were mostly at colonel rank. And you had a situation with low inflation and high economic growth, low unemployment, because the state took over many industries, pro-business incentives, public spending. This is why their Revolutionary Military Council maintained popularity. Communists were thrown in prison by the thousands at the time. The Greek military moved in at this time, late 60s, to end the stalemate in the Greek parliament, to stop the re-legalization of Marxism in Greece, since they were coming into power, to stop the total decay of the economy, and to stop the destruction of the Orthodox morals among the youth especially. The farmers were drowning in debt. Debt forgiveness was the top priority of the military government, and that tends to be the case in Latin America, not just in the Balkans. And the junta succeeded. It maintained a strong and prosperous Greece while they were in power. In terms of policy, though, which I haven't mentioned, Greece has to leave the European Union. It has to make its peace with both Russia and Turkey and become a part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS, or both. Of course, returning Greece to orthodoxy, with the media always in Greek hands, not in foreign hands. These are essential elements as well. Understand that the whole comes before the parts. The unity of the ethno-nation is more important than the individual. The individual and the person are two very different things. And that concludes the set of interview questions, and I just gave a very thumbnail version of these answers. But these are the foundational elements of my thinking on these things, especially relative to Greece and nationalism in general. I mean, there is a general nationalism, but it can't be fully understood unless you deal with a specific group of people. Political theory and comparative politics look at the same thing from two different points of view. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.